Hi, this is ETF.com's Exchange Traded Fridays podcast, a weekly podcast covering developments in the ETF industry. My name is Sumeet Roy, and I'm senior analyst for ETF.com. This week, I'm talking with Karen Vera, who is the head of iShares U.S. Fixed Income Strategy. Karen, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
So obviously, Karen, back in September, Powell and the Fed decided to keep interest rates unchanged, but they also suggested that another rate hike could be in the cards later this year. What's your take on the latest Fed decision?
Yes, a lot of investors are just nervously watching this. We've seen so many people who have been hesitant to really come into fixed income in a meaningful way until the rate hikes stop. We still see the door open for one more interest rate hike later this year. I think the November meeting is still a live meeting. After that, the December meeting, the Fed funds futures aren't quite sure which direction it's going to go. But we think we're in for higher for longer, and the Fed's going to pause for some period of time to make sure that the interest rate increases have been fully absorbed into the economy.
So, of course, Karen, all these interest rate hikes are to make sure that inflation comes down and stays down. We got some mixed readings recently on inflation. The CPI was a little worse than expected. The PCE was a little bit better than expected. Do you think that the inflation fight is largely over and inflation is going to head back to 2% next year?
I think 2% would be something that is not coming very, very quickly. So we are seeing, as you mentioned, the data is a little bit mixed. So the core PCE metric, which is, of course, the Fed's favorite metric in August, came in at 3.9% year over year. And so it's been the first time in 2 years that it's been under 4%. So I think we're seeing directionally, it is coming down. Things are getting absorbed. We're seeing in certain categories are still trending higher than expected. So our forecast is for inflation over the near term to remain in that 2-3% range. So coming down from where it is today, but not quite getting back to that 2% regime we used to be in.
Got it. So it certainly sounds like the Fed has to remain vigilant when it comes to inflation. And one way they said they plan to do that is by keeping rates higher for longer. But I'm curious, Karen, what does higher for longer mean to you? Is it 4%, 5%? And what if we get a recession? Where do rates go then?
Yeah, long term, the Fed, according to their summary of economic projections, wants to get that Fed funds target rate back down to that 2.5% range. So how are we going to get there? Currently, the yield curve shows us getting there over the next 2 or 3 years. However, you're right. If there's a recession that comes in, they're going to be forced to more aggressively reduce the Fed funds target rate. If we just think back to what happened during COVID, which was at this point over 3 years ago, they pretty dramatically had to cut interest rates in response to that crisis. So to the extent we start to see more weakness in the data or they think it's a full-on recession and need to stimulate the economy, what we tend to notice is they're very measured and slow about how they're increasing interest rates. I think this cycle was an exception with some big 50 and 75 basis point increases. But we tend to see on the way down, they do tend to get pretty aggressive and do some large cuts much quicker in the event of a recession.
And what do you think the odds of a recession are? Because heading into 2023, it seemed like everyone was expecting a recession. And now it's a little bit more mixed. Some people are calling for a soft landing. Other people are thinking we're still going to get that recession. It's just been pushed further out into the future.
One of my favorite metrics is, because I'm a fixed income person, is of course the shape of the yield curve. So if we look at just the difference between the twos and tens, which is whenever it goes inverted, meaning the 2-year point is higher than the 10-year point, that is typically a harbinger of sign of a recession. So we saw this metric go negative before the global financial crisis, and it was actually an inverted curve for about 9 months. At this point, we've had an inverted curve for over 14 months now, so even longer than before the financial crisis. So the yield curve has been predicting a potential recession for some time now. Even with all the Fed's interest rate increases, we haven't seen it take its toll on unemployment yet. So I'd say the job market has still been relatively strong. We're still seeing positive GDP growth. So I think so far we've seen some signs of that soft landing, but I think the yield curve and investors in general are still very, very tentative, very concerned about this. So we'll keep an eye on it, but I think it'll be very data dependent. And we'll just keep an eye on that yield curve and see how long it's going to keep flagging with that yield curve inversion.
I'm glad you brought up the yield curve because, yeah, it was very deeply inverted earlier this year, but more recently it seems like it's starting to steepen. We're seeing the 10-year creep up to, I think, around 4.7%, the 30-year at 4.8%. So we're seeing a steepening of the yield curve. And some people are even calling for these rates to go much higher to 5, 5.5%. When do you expect that we could see the long end of the curve top out in terms of interest rates?
Yeah, that term premium, meaning the extra yield you get for going further out in time, has really increased the last couple of months. So a couple factors are coming into play. The first was the downgrade of the U.S. to double A following the debt ceiling crisis. That has contributed some international investors not using as many treasuries or reducing their exposures to treasuries, which of course has put some upward pressure on interest rates. Some economic growth projections coming in better. And if you think about that lo those long-term rates, call it 10 to 30 years, those are really driven by real yields, so the yield of the economy without inflation, and of course inflationary expectations. So we're seeing that real yield curve is coming in about 2.5% today. And then if you tack on inflation expectations on another 2.5%, that easily gets you to 5% in some of those yield categories. So I think that's really what's driving that. And we could see them top out a bit more if we are continuing to see inflation remain stubbornly high, or if we continue to get positive GDP growth. So I think that's really what those long-term investors are looking at, is just those two factors, which both have remained elevated. So that's been driving those long-term yields.
So, Karen, obviously iShares has a lot of fixed income ETFs, but none has been more popular this year than TLT, which is your 20-plus year bond ETF. It's got about $17 billion in year-to-date inflows, but almost anyone who's bought that fund this year is underwater. Why is there so much money going into TLT despite the poor performance?
What we've seen is a lot of investors coming into this year were really underweight fixed income. The average financial advisor, if you just look at a 60-40 a moderate portfolio, and this is coming from data from BlackRock's Advisor Center using portfolios that financial advisors have input. So the average 60-40 portfolio coming into the year was about 9% underweight fixed income. And so I think what a lot of people were thinking, what is a capital efficient way for me to close some of those gaps? And what's a way to do it where I'm not taking on much credit risk? And so we have seen a lot of investors who have added duration with TLT because it is so long. It's just that 20 to 30 year part of the treasury curve. And so that's really what's been driving that, are people looking to add some duration opportunistically back to portfolios, especially at these current yield levels. There's more of a yield buffer than there normally would have been. But I think with yields rising, especially on the long end, that's really contributed to some of the negative performance we've seen in TLT this year.
Interesting. Another fund of yours that's seeing strong demand this year is S-Gov, which is almost like a money market fund. It's kind of the opposite of TLT, very little interest rate risk and a nice yield above 5% on that fund. Do you think that these ultra short-term treasury bond ETFs like S-Gov are attractive given that interest rates could stay higher for longer?
Yeah, I think what we saw in March, a lot of investors were rethinking where they were holding their cash. So while they were underweight fixed income, we saw a lot of people are still overweight cash. And with the regional bank crisis, nobody wanted to be over those FDIC insurance limits in the event that the bank they were working with had to go and work with the FDIC. So we saw a lot of money moving around, whether it was going to people were diversifying their bank CD portfolio, or they were looking for alternatives. And I think S-Gov, which just holds 0 to 3 month treasury securities, we launched that fund back in 2020, is a great way to just stick to the ultra short part of the curve, think T-bills. And then with yields above 5%, you can just kind of sit in that, collect some income, and then redeploy that when you see more opportunities to add back to either stocks or bonds. So I think that's just been one of the reasons why people have been going to ESCA, and we've seen $8 billion of inflows, are just people rethinking where they're holding their cash and the kind of vehicles they're using.
Now, Karen, we've talked a lot about treasuries, but I'd be curious to know what's your take on credit. We've seen spreads come in a little bit this year as those recession risks have kind of abated. Should investors take a closer look at funds like LQD and HYG?
I definitely think they should. When you take a look at the corporate credit market, we're still seeing the average credit spreads are a little bit higher higher than what we've seen historically. So you're getting that increased yield over treasuries. And I think a lot of investors who are looking for ways to reshape their bond portfolios, you now have such a yield buffer coming in because of the higher levels of interest rates. And we really haven't seen defaults tick up meaningfully. Even the high yield default rate is still right around 2%. And so I think we haven't seen the data materialize that recession hasn't taken place, and we think credit, particularly investment grade credit, is a way to go to add some more yield to portfolios, take on a little bit of incremental risk outside of treasuries. We're still more cautious on high yield, just given where we are in the cycle. But still, if you're someone who's really driven by income, high yield now offers an 8% yield. Before this year, you really had to go to private credit to get those kinds of yields on securities. So we are seeing people who are opportunistically adding to high yield, but in general, the category's been out of favor. And we've still seen a lot of people using investment grade credit bond ETFs as a way to add some yield to portfolios.
I want to turn now to some of your new ETFs. I know that you recently expanded your iBonds ETF suite to include TIPS funds. I'd love it if you could give us an overview of that suite and tell us how investors are using iBonds more broadly.
Absolutely. iBonds are our term maturity ETFs. So these are ETFs that are designed to mature like a bond, trade like a stock, and they're diversified like a fund. We originally launched these back in 2010, so we have over 13 years of history. We've actually had over 30 of our iBonds mature over the years. We currently have about $24 billion across the suite, and we've seen almost $6.7 billion of inflows into the iBonds this year. And more investors were looking to buy fixed income and just hold it to maturity. So we started with munis, but then we expanded to investment grade corporates, then treasuries, high yield, and the last few weeks we've actually added TIPS as well. So we think the TIPS launch is important because if we're going to be in a higher inflationary regime going forward, so many investors are looking for ways to allocate more inflation protection to portfolios. And if you think about what a TIPS security is designed to do is it's issued by the US government. They started issuing them in 1997. And the principal value is adjusted with the consumer price index. So every month, they take that monthly change in the non-seasonally adjusted consumer price index and apply that to the principal value of the bonds. And then the coupon rate that is set at the auction is then applied to that amount. So you get a little bit of inflation return both in your principal value increasing and that coupon potentially increasing over time with changes in inflation. And I think for a lot of investors, trading a TIP, buying a TIP bond can be a little bit difficult. They don't know how to do it. So I think the iBonds really allow them an easy access vehicle to buy TIPS and then be able to hold them to maturity to build a TIPS ladder to really preserve their purchasing power after inflation.
And another suite of bond ETFs that you launched not too long ago, Karen, is your buy right fixed income ETFs. I think we've seen over $900 million of inflows year to date into those ETFs. TLTW in particular has been really popular. Can you tell us more about how these products work?
Yes. So our buy right suite kind of brings together some ideas that people have been doing for quite some time in the equity markets. So if you held a concentrated stock position, one of the ways you could diversify that position over time and increase the amount of income was to implement a covered call strategy. That's where you could be selling a call option into the market, collecting the current premium, and then in the event that stock goes up, it might get called away from you. So it would be a disciplined way of selling into a rising environment. So with the advent of our bond ETFs, we've seen an options markets arisen on our largest and most liquid funds. So TLT, as we talked about already, 20 plus treasuries, HYG, our high yield ETF, and LQD all have robust put and calls options markets. So we worked with the Chicago Board of Options Exchange, CBOE, and they're the index provider on this fund. And they helped us create an index where it holds, and the fund itself will hold positions in TLT, and it will write a 1 month call option. And when those call options expire, we're going to roll them the day before expiry. And the fund will collect the income on the option. It will also pass through the income on the bond portfolio. So it's a way for investors, if they think that interest rates are going to continue to go sideways, that higher for longer mandate that we talked about, or potentially lower in the future, this could be a way to collect additional current income from the options premium. So we've seen the 12-month trailing yields on a TLTW, for example, are about 18%. The current SEC yield has decreased to about 13% as we've seen a little bit less volatility coming into the market. So while we've seen these buy right strategies have been really popular in equities, this is the first time we've been able to offer them in a fixed income solution.
That's amazing. So 18%, that certainly sounds very compelling. What kind of risks are there with that kind of product? I'm assuming, you're still exposed to the downside of the bond market, and you might not capture as much upside if we see a big rally in long bonds. Is that right?
That's right. So you can think about you're kind of getting that underlying fixed income exposure, and then it does get you do are trading off some of that upside potential for that current levels of income. And then of course with TLT with HYGW and LQDW, you're also experiencing potentially the credit risk from those two asset classes. So I think that those are some of the risks. If you want to see, the full prospectuses and everything, we've got them on our website that outlines it in more detail. But I think that's probably the biggest risk is they are still holding the underlying portfolio of bonds, who are exposed to all the same risks of the bond market, as well as just the change in value of the option as well during that period.
That's great. So, Karen, we've touched on a lot of topics and a lot of ETFs. Before I let you go, are there any other topics or funds we haven't talked about that you think are relevant to fixed income investors?
Yeah, I'd say one of the other big flow trends that we've seen this year are just with core bond funds. Funds like AGG have also seen about $10 billion of inflows this year. And I think a lot of investors are using AGG as a simple way to close those bond positions, meaning getting a little bit closer to their benchmark duration or benchmark weight for fixed income. Also, we're seeing one of the biggest opportunities right now is through tax loss harvesting. Last year, a lot of investors were able to tax loss harvest in fixed income because rising rates gave way to negative price returns on many bond funds. In fact, we saw $530 billion being redeemed out of fixed income mutual funds, and almost $200 billion of that went back into ETFs. With rates coming up, particularly on the long end of the curve this year, we're seeing negative price returns for the core and core plus bond categories on both the 1, 3, and 5 year basis. So even if you tax loss harvested last year, there could be an opportunity to do it again in fixed income. And then you could use bond ETFs to reposition those portfolios for this higher for longer environment.
Well, fantastic, Karen. A ton of great information. Thanks so much for sharing your insights with us.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, I hope you enjoyed this episode. You can find this and all other Exchange Traded Fridays episodes on ETF.com or on any major podcast platform. See you next week.